Immediately after stand down, when another crew would assume the arduous waiting of standby, David would change into a tracksuit and run for 5 or 6 miles to get the stiffness out of his body and to have his sweat wash away the staleness. He was looking forward to that. Afterwards, he would... There was a sharp crackle in his earphones and a new voice. Red standby, go, go! The command was repeated over loudspeakers in the underground bunker, and the ground crew boiled into action. With all his pre-flight checks and routine long ago completed, David merely pushed his throttle to starting position, and the whine of the stators showed immediate results. The engine caught, and he ran up his power to 100%. Ahead of him, the blast doors were lifting. Bright Lance 2, this is Leader, going to take off power. 2 conforming, said Joe, and they went screaming up the ramp and hurled themselves at the sky. Hello, Desert Flower, this is Bright Lance, airborne and climbing. Bright Lance, this is the brig. David was not surprised to find that he was in charge of command plot. Distinctive voices and the use of personal names would prevent any chance of the enemy confusing the net with false messages. David, we have an intruder approach at high level that should enter our airspace in 4 minutes, if it continues on its present course. We are tracking him at 75,000 feet, which means it is either an American U-2, which is highly unlikely, or that it is a Russian spy plane coming over to have a look at our latest dispersals. Beseda, sir, David acted. We're going to try for a storm climb to intercept as soon as the target becomes hostile in our airspace. Beseda, sir. Level at 20,000 feet, turn to 186, and go to maximum speed for storm climb. At 20,000, David went to straight and level flight and glanced into his mirror to see Joe's Mirage hanging out on his tail. Bright Lance 2, this is Leader, commencing run now. 2 conforming. David lit his tail and pushed the throttle open to maximum afterburner position. The Mirage jumped away, and David let the nose drop slightly to allow the speed to build up quickly. They went blazing through the sound barrier without a check, and David retrimmed for supersonic flight, thumbing the little top hat on the end of his stick. Their speed rocketed swiftly through Mach 1.2, Mach 1.5. The Mirages were stripped of all but their essentials. There were no missiles dangling beneath them, no auxiliary fuel tanks to create drag. The only weapons they carried were their 2 30-millimeter cannons. Flying lightly, they drove on up the Mach scale, streaking from Beersheba to Eilat in the time it would take a man to walk a city block. Their speed stabilized at Mach 1.9, just short of the heat barrier. David, this is the brig. We're tracking you. You are on correct course and speed for interception. Prepare to commence climb in 16 seconds. Beseda, sir. Counting now. 8, 7, 6, 2, 1, go, go! David tensed his body, and as he pulled up the nose of the Mirage, he opened his mouth and screamed to fight off the effects of gravity. But despite these precautions and the constricting grip of his pressure suit, the abrupt change of direction crammed him down into his seat, and the blood drained out of his head so that his vision went grey and then black. The Mirage was standing on her tail, still flying at very nearly twice the speed of sound, and as his vision returned, David glanced at the G-meter and saw that he had subjected his body to nearly 9 times the force of gravity to achieve this attitude of climb without loss of speed. Now he lay on his back and stared up at the empty sky while the needle of his altimeter raced upwards and his speed gradually eroded away. A quick sweep showed Joe's Mirage rock steady in position below him, climbing in concert with him. And his voice came through, calm and reassuring. Leader, this is 2. I have contact with target. Even under the stress of storm climb, Joe was busy manipulating his beloved radar. And he had picked up the spy plane high above them. In this maneuver, they were trading speed for height, and as one increased, so the other drained away. They were like a pair of arrows aimed directly upwards. The bowstring could throw them just so far, and then they would hang there in space for a few moments until they were drawn irresistibly back to Earth. In those few moments, they must find and kill the enemy. David lay back in his seat and watched with fresh wonder as the sky turned darker blue and then slowly became the midnight black of space, shot through with the fiery prickings of the stars. They were at the top edge of the stratosphere, high above the highest clouds or signs of weather as known to Earth. Outside the cockpit, the air was thin and weak, insufficient for life, hardly sufficient to keep the jets of the Mirage's engines burning, and the cold was a fearsome 60 degrees of frost. The two aircraft slowly ran out of energy, and they came out together at the top of a mighty parabola. The sensation of flight was gone. They swam through the dark, forbidding oceans of space, and far below them the Earth glowed strangely with a weird, unnatural light. There was no time to admire the view. The Mirage was wallowing in the thin and treacherous air, her control surfaces skidding and sliding without bite. Joe was on the target, tracking quietly and steadily, and they came round carefully onto the heading, with the aircraft staggering mushily and beginning to fall away from these inhospitable heights. David stared ahead, holding the Mirage's nose up for sustained altitude, but already the stall warning device was flicking amber and red at him. He was running out of time and height. Then suddenly he saw it, seeming startlingly close in the rare air, ghosting along on its immense wings like a black manta ray through the sable and silent sea of space. Ahead and slightly below them, calmly and silently it drifted along, its height giving it a false sense of invulnerability. "Desert Flower, this is Bright Lance, visual on the intruder and requesting permission for strike." David's cool tone hid the sudden gust of his anger and hatred that the sighting had released. "Report your target." The brig was hedging. It was a dangerous decision to call the strike on an unknown target. "Desert Flower, it's an Aleutian Mark 1711. No apparent markings." It needed no marking. It could only belong to one nation. David was closing fast. He could fly no slower than this, and he was rapidly overhauling the other machine. Those huge wings were designed to float upon the feeble air of the stratosphere. "Closing fast," he warned Desert Flower. "Opportunity for strike will pass in approximately 10 seconds. The silence in his headphones hummed quickly, and he readied his cannons and watched the spy plane blowing up rapidly in size as he dropped down upon it. Suddenly, the brig made the decision, perhaps committing his country to heavy retaliation, but knowing that the spy plane's cameras were steadily recording vital details of their ability to resist aggression, information that would be passed quickly to their enemies. "David," his voice was curt and harsh, "this is the brig. Hit him. Beseda." David let the Mirage's nose drop a fraction, and she responded gratefully. "Two, this is Leader attacking. Two, conforming." He went down on the Aleutian so fast that as she came into his sights, he knew he had time for only a few seconds of fire. He pressed the trigger with the aiming pipper on the spy plane's wing roots, and he saw her rear up like a great fish struck by the steel of the harpoon. For 3 seconds, he poured his cannon shells into her and watched them flash and twinkle against the massive black silhouette. Then he was through, falling away below the giant's belly with his power spent, dropping away like the burnt-out shell of a rocket. Joe came down astern of him, backing up the attack, and in his sights the spy plane hung helplessly on its wide wings, its long rounded nose pointing to the black sky with its cold, uncaring stars. He pressed the trigger, and the plane broke up amidst the bright flashes of exploding cannon shells. One wing snapped off at its root, and the carcass began its long, slow tumble down the heavens. "Hello, Desert Flower, this is Bright Lance Leader. Target destroyed." David tried to keep his voice level, but he found his hands were trembling and his guts were aching cold from the spillover of his hatred that not even the enemy's death could expunge. Again he pressed the button to open the flight net. "Joe, that's one more for Hannah," he said. But for once there was no reply, and after he had listened in vain to the throb of the carrier beam for a few seconds, he closed it and activated his Doppler gear for a homing signal, and silently Joe followed him back to base. Deborah had been a steadying and maturing influence, but now David reacted so wildly to her going that Joe had to continue his role of wingman even when they were off base. They spent much of their leisure time together, for although they seldom mentioned their loss, yet the sharing of it drew them closer. Often Joe slept over at Malik Street, for his own home was a sad and depressing place now. The brig was seldom there in these troubled times, Deborah gone and his mother was so altered by her terrible experience that she was grey and broken, aged beyond her years. The bullet wound in her body had closed, but there was other damage that would never heal. David's wildness was a craving for the forgetfulness of constant action. He was only truly at peace when he was in the air, and on the ground he was restless and mercurial. Joe moved, big and calm, beside him, steering him tactfully out of trouble with a slow grin and an easy word. As a consequence of the downed spy plane, the Syrians began a policy of provocative patrols, calculated infringement of Israeli airspace, which was discontinued as soon as retaliation was drawn. As the interceptors raced to engage, they would swing away, declining combat, and move back within their own borders. Twice David saw the greenish luminous blur of these hostile patrols on the screen of his scanning radar, and each time he had surprised himself with the icy feeling of anger and hatred that had lain heavy as a rock upon his heart and lungs as he led Joe in on the interception. Each time, however, the Syrians had been warned by their own radar and they had turned away, increasing speed and withdrawn discreetly and mockingly. Bright Lance, this is Desert Flower. Target is no longer hostile. Discontinue attack pattern. The Syrians' MiG-21s had crossed their own frontier, and each time David had answered quietly, "Two, this is Leader," discontinuing attack pattern and resuming scan. The tactics were designed to wear on the nerves of the defenders, and in all the interceptor squadrons the tension was becoming explosive. The provocation was pushing them to the edge of restraint. Incidents were only narrowly being averted, as the hotbloods crowded their interceptions to the very frontiers of war. Finally, however, there had to come intervention from above as Desert Flower tried to hold them on a tighter leash. They sent the brig to talk to his crews, and as he stood on the dais and looked about the crowded briefing room, he realized that it was unfair to train the hawk and then keep the hood over his eyes and the thong upon his leg, to hold him upon the wrist when the wild duck were flighting overhead. He started at a philosophical level, taking advantage of the regard that he knew his young pilots had for him. The object of war is peace. The ultimate strategy of any commander is peace. There was no response from his audience. The brig caught the level scrutiny of his own son. How could he talk of placation to a trained warrior who had just buried the mutilated body of his bride? The brig ploughed on manfully. Only a fool allows himself to be drawn onto a field of the enemy's choosing. He was reaching them now. I won't have one of you young pups pushing us into something we are not ready for. I don't want to give them an excuse. That is what they want. They were thawing now. He saw a head nod thoughtfully and heard a murmur of agreement. Any of you looking for big trouble, you don't have to go to Damascus. You know my address. He tried for his first laugh and got it. They were chuckling now. All right then, we don't want trouble. We're going to lean right over backwards to prevent it. But we are not going to fall on our asses. When the time comes, I'll give you the word, and it won't be the soft word or the other cheek. They growled then, a fierce little sound, and he ended it. But you wait for that word. La Dauphin stood up and took over from the brig. All right, while I've got you all together, I have a little news for you that may help to cool the hotheads who want to follow the MiGs over the border. He motioned to the projection box at the end of the briefing room. The lights went down, and there was a shuffling of feet and an outburst of coughing. A voice protested resignedly. Oh, not another film show. Yes, the colonel took it up. Another film show. Then, as the images began to flash upon the screen, he went on. This is a military intelligence film, and the subject is a new ground-to-air missile system that has been delivered by the Soviet Army to the armies of the Arab Union. The code name for the system is Serpent, and it updates the existing SAM-3 system. As far as we know, the system has been installed and is operative in the Syrian defensive perimeter, and will shortly be installed by the Egyptians. It is manned at present by Russian instructors. As the colonel went on talking, the brig sat back in his chair and watched their faces in the silver reflection from the screen. They were intent and serious. Men looking for the first time on the terrible machines that might be the instrument of their own deaths. The missile is fired from a tracked vehicle. Here you see aerial reconnaissance shots of a mobile column. Notice that each vehicle carries a pair of missiles, and you will realize that they constitute an enormous threat. The brig picked out the marvelously pure profile of David Morgan as he leaned forward to study the screen, and he felt a pang of sympathy and sorrow for him. And yet this was underlined by a new respect, a realignment of judgment. The boy had proved himself to be constant, capable of embracing an ideal and remaining loyal to it. The improvements in design of the Serpent are not certain, but it is believed that the missile is capable of greater speeds, probably in the order of Mach 2.5, and that the guidance system is a combination of both infrared heat seeker and the computerized radar control. Watching the handsome young face, he wondered if Deborah had not misjudged his reserves. It was possible that he would have been capable of... No, the brig shook his head and groped for a cigarette. He was too young, too greedy for life, spoiled by good looks and riches. He would not be capable of it. Deborah was right, as so often was the case. She had chosen the correct course. She could never hold him. She must set him free. It is expected that the Serpent is capable of engaging targets at altitudes between 1,500 feet and 75,000 feet. There was a stir amongst the listeners as they assessed the threat of this new weapon. The warhead delivers a quarter of a ton of explosive, and it is armed with a proximity fuse which is set to fire if the target is passed at a range less than 150 feet. Within these limits, the Serpent is lethal. The brig was still watching David. Ruth and he had not seen the boy at their home for many months. He had come with Joe to spend the Sabbath evening with them twice after the outrage. However, the atmosphere had been stiff and artificial, everybody carefully avoiding mention of Deborah's name. He had not come again after the second time, nearly 6 months ago. Evasive tactics at this stage will be the same as for Sam 3. Prayer and good luck, someone interjected, and that raised a laugh. Maximum rate turn towards the missile to screen the radiation from your jet blasts and attempt to force the Serpent to overshoot. In the event that the missile continues to track, you should climb into the sun and then make another maximum rate turn. The missile may then accept the sun's infrared radiation as a more tempting target. And if that doesn't work, a voice called, and another answered flippantly. Repeat the following. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. But this time nobody laughed at the old blasphemy. The brig timed his departure from the briefing room to fall in beside David. When are we going to see you, David? It's been a long time. I'm sorry, sir. I hope Joe made my apologies. Yes, of course, but why don't you come with Joe this evening? God knows there'll be enough food. I'll be very busy tonight, sir, David declined lamely. I understand. And as they reached the door of the OC's office, the brig paused. Remember, you are always welcome. And he turned away. Sir, the brig stopped and looked back at him. David spoke rapidly, almost guiltily. How is she, sir? And then again, how's Deborah? Have you seen her? I mean, recently. She is well, the brig answered heavily. As well as she can be. Will you tell her, I asked? No, answered the brig, ignoring the pleading in the dark blue eyes. No, you know I can't do that. David nodded and turned away. For a moment, the brig looked after him, and then with a frown, he went on into the colonel's office. David dropped Joe in Ain Karim at the entrance to the lane, and then he drove on into the main shopping area of East Jerusalem and parked outside the big new supermarket in Melech George V to do his shopping for the weekend ahead. He was hanging over the freezer tray, pondering the delicate choice between lamb cutlets and steak, when he became aware that he was being watched. David looked up quickly and saw that she was a statuesque woman with a thick mane of blonde curls. She stood beside the shelves further down the aisle. Her hair was dyed. He could see the dark shadow of the roots, and she was older than he was, with a womanly heaviness in her hips and bosom and tiny lines at the corners of her eyes. She was eyeing him, a steady appraisal so unashamedly sensual that he felt the check in his breathing and the quick stirring of his loins. He looked back at the meat in the freezer, guilty and angry with the treachery of his body. It had been so long, so very long, since he had experienced sexual awareness. He had believed that he never would again. He wanted to throw the pack of steak back into the freezer and leave, but he stood rooted with the breathless feeling squeezing his lungs, and he was aware of the woman's presence at his side. He could feel the warmth of her on his arm and smell her. The flowery perfume mingled with the natural musky odor of the sexually aroused female. "The steak is very good," she said. She had a light, sweet voice, and he recognized the same breathless quality as his own. He looked at her. Her eyes were green, and her teeth were a little crooked, but white. She was even older than he had thought, almost 40. She wore her dress low in front. He could see the crepe effect of the skin between her breasts. The breasts were big and motherly, and suddenly David wanted to lay his head against them. They looked so soft and warm and safe. "You should cook it rare, with mushrooms and garlic and red wine," she said. "It's very good that way." "Is it?" he asked hoarsely. "Yes," she nodded, smiling. "Who will cook it for you? Your wife? Your mother?" "No," said David. "I'll cook it myself. I live alone." And she leaned a little closer to him, her breast touching his arm. David was dizzy and hot with the brandy. He had bought a bottle of it at the supermarket, and he had drunk it mixed with ginger ale to mask the spirituous taste. He had drunk it fast, and now he leaned over the basin in the bathroom and felt the house rock and sway about him. He steadied himself, gripping the edge of the basin. He splashed cold water onto his face and shook off the drops. Then he grinned stupidly at himself in the mirror above the basin. His hair was damp and hung onto his forehead. He closed one eye and the wavering image in the mirror hardened and squinted back at him. "Hi there, boy," he muttered, and reached for the towel. He had dripped water down his tunic, and this annoyed him. He threw the towel over the toilet seat and went back into the living room. The woman was gone. The leather couch still carried the indentation of her backside, and the dirty plates were on the olive wood table. The air was thick with cigarette smoke and her perfume. "Where are you?" he called thickly, swaying slightly in the doorway. "Here, big boy." He went to the bedroom. She lay on the bed, naked, plump and white, with huge, soft breasts and swelling belly. He stared at her. "Come on, Davy." Her clothing was thrown across the dressing table, and he saw that her corsets were grey and unwashed. Her hair was yellow against the soft ivory lacework. "Come to Mama," she whispered hoarsely, opening her limbs languidly in invitation. She was spread upon the brass bed, upon the lace cover which had been Deborah's, and David felt his anger surge within him. "Get up," he said, slurring the words. "Come on, baby. Get off that bed." His voice tightened, and she heard the tone and sat up with mild alarm. "What is it, Davy?" "Get out of here." His voice was rising sharply. "Get out, you bitch. Get out of here." He was shaking now, his face pale and his eyes savage blue. Quivering with panic, she climbed hurriedly from the bed, the great white breasts and buttocks wobbling with ridiculous haste as she stuffed them into the grey corset. When she had gone, David went through into the bathroom and vomited into the toilet bowl. Then he cleaned the house, scouring pans and plates, polishing the glasses until they shone, emptying the ashtrays, opening the shutters to blow out the stench of cigarette and perfume. And finally, going through into the bedroom, he stripped and remade the bed with fresh sheets and smoothed the lace cover carefully until not a crease or wrinkle showed. He put on a clean tunic and his uniform cap and drove to the Jaffa Gate. He parked the car in the lot outside the gate and walked through the old city to the reconstructed Sephardic synagogue in the Jewish quarter. It was very quiet and peaceful in the high-domed hall, and he sat a long time on the hard wooden bench.